Hey there, everybody. This week's episode is kicking off with one of our favorite sponsors. That's right, Lumi Labs are the masters of microdosing, and they want me to explain to you good people the benefits of microdosing using their Delta-9 THC gummies. If you're stressed out or your mind likes to run a million miles a minute, then you might want to give Lumi gummies a try. They offer indica, sativa, and hybrid gummies that are designed to be taken in smaller doses to maintain a level of calm throughout the day. Or if you just want the pleasant sensation of being a little bit stoned, you can take a couple more and you're good to go. I'm not your dad. You can enjoy these gummies however you wish. I usually use them to help me get to sleep at night. When I am out, I am up till the crack of dawn, and that is not good for a human sleep schedule. They're one of our longest sponsors, and Scott and I can vouch at their quality. And you can get them sent straight to your door no matter what the marijuana laws are where you live. So check out microdose.com and see their wares. If you decide to pick something up, make sure to use the code KINGCAST at checkout to get 30% off and get free shipping. That's microdose.com, code KINGCAST.
Very well done, Eric. And I am here today to point you in the direction of Justin White and John Compapiano's Unearthed and Untold, The Path to Pet Cemetery. The duo's 2015 documentary chronicles the origins of Stephen King's best-selling horror novel, Pet Cemetery, as well as the subsequent film based on his novel. Through extensive interviews, this documentary showcases the stories of many original cast and crew members while highlighting how the local communities in Maine played an invaluable role in making the film. Why are we talking about this today? Well, we're fans of White and Compapiano's doc, sure, but also, this year marks the 35th anniversary of Mary Lambert's beloved film, and we figured, what better time to remind people that Unearthed and Untold exists? By the way, these are the same two guys who directed the awesome 2022 documentary Pennywise, The Story of It. So if you like what they did there, you're sure to dig this one. Unearthed and Untold is currently available to rent or buy via Amazon Prime Video or Fandango at Home, previously known as Vudu.
What a perfect ad for this show. That's like designed specifically for our show. I love it.
Yes.
And then that leaves the house ad, which is up to me this week. And so I am going to jump in and tell you about Fangoria, which has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door four times a year. Each issue is filmed to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including your intrepid KingCast hosts. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you'll need to subscribe. And to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com to sign up. And guess what? If you use the code KingCast at checkout, you will save a gargantuan 25% off of your subscription.
Very well said. Let's get on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm Eric Vespi.
And I'm Scott Wampler.
And we are your hosts. Today we are joined by a legendary director to talk about one of the most iconic and controversial Stephen King adaptations. The topic at hand is The Shining, and our guest has given us films about killer sharks, terrorized airports, dream masters, amnesiac assassins, and even psychotic John Lithgow's, my personal favorite flavor of John Lithgow, I might add.
Yes.
Now he's taking on a new trilogy set in the creepy, stalkery home invasion world of The Strangers, the first installment of which is coming out this Friday, May 17th. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Rennie Harlan to the KingCast stage. Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure to talk with you guys.
Yeah, I know it's and that goes without saying, it's an honor, you know, but the honor is, I can say, is way more of a one-way street. Thank you. I never in a million years would have guessed that we would have gotten you on this show, and I'm really grateful for you to come on.
This is such a cool site you guys have, and to be such I feel completely intimidated because you guys are such Stephen King experts and aficionados that I feel like, embarrassed to say anything, but I'll try.
No. This is not an academic show. We are
excellent.
We have no idea what we're doing basically at any given time. You are
okay. Then we are like yeah, three or four or five peas in a pod.
Yes, exactly. And I just want to echo what Eric said. this isn't a question, but this is just something I want to tell you because I don't know if I'm ever going to get a chance to talk to you again. My formative years as a film geek started around the mid 80s to the late 90s. Like during that time, I was just hoovering up everything that I possibly could, and it turned me into a lifelong movie fan. And there is a solid decade there where Nightmare on Elm Street 4, Die Hard 2, Cliffhanger, Long Kiss Goodnight, Deep Blue Sea, just one banger after another. You fucking rule, man. Like I am so excited to be talking to you, and thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you to say. But those were fun years, definitely. And I've been very lucky to just keep working and keep making movies and various movies you make for various reasons and different reasons. But that just happened to be a time, you know, I had just come to Hollywood and got very fortunate to start with Nightmare on Elm Street 4, and then it just started rolling from there. So, you know,
yeah.
Maybe people sometimes think that it just all happened so easily, but they don't know the 5 years before Nightmare on Elm Street, that was just a complete crawl over broken glass. But it's been a good run, and I'm really glad that you've enjoyed some of the movies.
Mm. Yes. Well, I mean, you've made Nightmare 4 is legitimately like one of the gnarliest movies in the whole mm-hmm. series. And it's probably one of the ones I rewatched the most as a kid. And I don't know, from the cockroach scene to like the pizza with the faces on it and shit. It's like that thing has stuck me in ways that series doesn't. I was a diehard Freddy, kid, like most kids of the 80s, which is really screwed up when you think about it. But he was kind of a rock star for children, and being that he was a child murderer, that was kind of interesting. But it is saying something that you got to do one of the gnarliest in that zone when he was still kind of scary, but also funny and,
I really appreciate you saying that. And I'm just going to just blatantly jump in and say, those two things that you just mentioned, I take completely credit for, because without now going to an hour long story about this movie, I just want to mention that you may know that how I got involved in that whole movie was that they had a mandate to make the fourth one. They had a release date. They didn't really have a script. And then the writer's strike started. And so they had no script, no director, no nothing. And they had to make the movie. And then through some lucky coincidences, I step in and I start pounding on their door saying that I got to make this movie. And they don't respond at all. So I just start drawing these nightmares into storyboards and like with no script. I just start coming up with sequences, and I just vividly remember, since you mentioned it, I just have to tell you, I vividly remember going into Bob Shea's office. He was the chairman and basically the founder of New Line Cinema. I pretty much broke through security into his office and like slammed a pile of storyboards on his desk, and I said, "A pizza. Freddy has captured all his victims in the pizza." And Bob Shea looks at me like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" Imagine it. It's like pepperoni and sausage and meatballs, and their faces are in the pizza. It's going to be awesome. And they're like, "Security, get this guy out of here." But obviously, I left the storyboards, and then he started leafing through them, and he's like, "Maybe this is genius." And same thing with Cockroach, that I took like from Edgar Allan Poe, basically, and from my like childhood nightmares. And I'll just mention that the waterbed was also, it was like why I met with my wet nightmare. So I had the opportunity to just like inundate them with crazy nightmare ideas. And then they started feeling like, okay, we don't have a script, we can't hire a writer, so at least we have these nightmares. So maybe we could like build a movie around this. And then with Mike DeLuca's help, who was then just a lower level executive there, and with the producer Rachel Talalay, and we just put our heads together and came up with the story and this kind of a female empowerment story of Alice, the heroine, and put the movie together, like literally writing it as we were shooting it. So it was just a wild, wild ride. And since you also mentioned that sort of thing about Freddy's evolution, I want to just quickly mention that I had, of course, seen all three previous ones many times. And I said to them that you can't quite sell the concept anymore that he's just purely scary and blah, blah, blah. Like, you have to kind of wink at the audience a little bit and say, like, okay, we are in on it with you. And I said, I always remember, like, my one sentence pitch for the movie was like, you gotta make Freddy the James Bond of horror. And it's kind of sick and scary and weird to say something like that, because he is a child murderer. But that's what we did. And if you know, in that movie, the whole introductory shot of when Freddy has been resurrected, how camera moves in on him in this low angle and everything, I just wanted him to make this into this like a bigger than life kind of a hero character. And also we added a lot of humor into the movie. And it was a big gamble. And I remember they all thought that, you know, I was either going to like make it or just destroy their franchise. And it wasn't until we had our test screening, you know, just a few weeks before the release of the movie at Warner Hollywood. And all of a sudden the audience starts like, you know, screaming and yelling and laughing and clapping and stomping and giving standing ovations. And Bob Shea looked at me and he said, "You fucking kid, I think you did it." And, and so you know, sorry to like go on a complete sidetrack here, but that was very inspired me to like go down the memory lane a little bit.
Well, I had that effect on people, so I understand.
It's always a pleasure to see you working in the horror genre, and that's what you're doing with the new movie, The Strangers. In fact, it's three new movies. This is a trilogy that is kicking off. The first one comes out on May 17th, and you shot all three of these between September and November of 2022. My question is, are you insane? Three movies back to back? Like, how are you even organizing that in your brain? Like, how are you?
Actually, yes, I am insane. And secondly, if they were shot back to back, that would make it easy. But they were not shot back to back. They were shot on top of each other because, you know, I was basically given like 50 days to shoot all three movies. But I think we took about 54 days in the end of it. Mm-hmm. And most of them were just very long, dark nights. And for the reasons that there are certain overlapping locations, Not at all to say at all that all three movies take place in the same place. Not at all. But let's say, you know, for example, the house from the first movie, you may see it also in second and the third movie, even briefly. So we had certain locations that were overlapping. And of course, it makes sense that once you go in the house, you shoot all the scenes in the house. And once you are in a certain part of the forest, you shoot all the scenes in that part of the forest. You don't want to travel there twice and put up the lights and cameras and all the stuff. So, as we all know, movies are always shot completely out of order. But here was a 280-page script, and I'm sure everybody who listens to you knows that scripts are normally around 100 pages. So this was 280 pages, and we made basically a 4.5-hour epic odyssey, horror odyssey, and split it into three parts. It was really schizophrenic because we could be shooting Monday morning, we could be shooting episode 3, Monday afternoon episode 1, and Tuesday morning episode 2. So for the crew, just, you know, if you think of wardrobe and makeup and props and set design, like, you have to go from, okay, now Mads is covered in blood with torn clothes, crawling on the ground, barely able to move. And 2 hours later, she's pristine, beautiful, completely clean-faced, and just arriving in town and looking really happy. And the challenge of, you know, like, for the actors to always be in the correct mental state for every scene be able to map out where are we in the journey. And also, you know, for me, obviously, I wanted to give all the three movies like a visual arc in terms of lighting and camera angles and lenses, and be able to tell the actors where are they when we are shooting this scene, and remind them. And easily, I would say, for lesser actors, the instinct would be just to like just go all out. Like, here I am alone at home or in this house, and there's a knock on the door, and I see this scary figure outside, and you know, I'm super scared, and I start hyperventilating, and I start tearing up, and I'm panicking. But you know, that may just be like the first little hint of terror in the movie, and we have still 4.5 hours to go. So if you start crying and panicking in every scene, when I cut it together, it's just going to be like a total cry fest, and people will start throwing tomatoes at the screen. So I had like emotional charts for every character and crying charts where, like, even if our every instinct was like, okay, we are in the middle of the forest. We've been shooting now for 4.5 weeks and we are dead tired and we are doing this super tough scene and it's really scary. And all your instincts are screaming, go all out, just cry and just, you know, lose it. But then I look at my chart and they said, nope, you can't lose it here. You know, remember what's going to happen after this. You just got to keep your cool. You're going to be scared. You're looking around, but no tears in this scene. And it, like, we just had to trust the original plan and not get caught up in the moment. And so, yeah, it was a very challenging thing to do, but at the same time, like, super exhilarating. It was just, we were all like on a mission, and like, for me, I felt like this is a chance of a lifetime to expand on a great movie, the original The Strangers, made about 16 years ago, to be able to take that premise, but not to do a sequel or a prequel or a remake, but take kind of like that universe and expand on it and spend 4.5 hours taking a deep dive into the psyche of these characters, including the, you know, victims like Mads, who survives, obviously, the first movie, and then the perpetrators and like what makes them tick. And intention not being like, okay, let's answer every question and tie a neat bow on top of it all. No, but let's just explore this stuff and create more questions and more intrigue. And you know, you don't get to do that in movies unless you're like Coppola and you can make like a 4-hour movie, like, well, you know, like Godfather or Apocalypse Now or something like that. But we mere mortals, you know, we just had to stick to like 90 minutes pretty much. So, right. So it was just a great, great opportunity.
Can I ask you a somewhat personal question?
Yes.
This is, and I typically wouldn't ask this, but it's because it's such a unique situation where you're on this shoot that's 54 days long and you are filming technically 3 movies. Are you getting paid 3 times or are you just getting paid once for the entire job?
You should be my agent, because I was so not getting paid 3 times. I think I was somehow like hoodwinked into this thing, just like getting caught up in the excitement of it all and not really thinking about it. So yeah, they producers kept saying like, it's just one really epic big movie, and I bought into it. So I'm so not getting paid for 3 movies, and you know, that's gonna change when we make the next 3.
Oh my God, you are entertaining as shit to talk to. This is great.
You guys, Eric, are awesome. You got the next,
you need to make the Hobbits of the Strangers trilogy next. So
totally. No, but it's fun to talk with you guys, because you are experts, you are fans, and you are enthusiastic and you're funny. So it inspires.
look at this charmer here.
Yeah.
Love it. It's like, oh, go on. Keep going.
Eric, you got next question. Please.
Funnily enough, all my questions about The Strangers you just talked about, like, you just covered everything that I'd wanted to know about, like the logistics of doing all that stuff. I spent some time on the set of Lord of the Rings, and that sounds exactly like what it's like. They would have one unit over here doing that, and then everybody would change clothes and suddenly they wouldn't be battle torn. You know, I don't know. That's got to be so surreal. And it honestly just makes me exhausted hearing you talk about it, because there's so many things everybody has to keep straight.
But for you to have been able to be there on the set of Lord of the Rings, that must have been mind blowing. Because I mean, and that's such huge filmmaking. You know, I heard that they had several units going, and every unit was bigger than the other one, and it, that was that was really epic stuff.
It was bizarre because I would like go past Peter Jackson's monitor and he would have the two or three cameras he was shooting on the stage in Wellington, and he would have like I think four TVs like below that, and each one of those was a direct tap into the unit that was shooting. Some there was one that was shooting in the South Island of New Zealand. There was one that was, you know, shooting in another stage in Wellington. There was one, you know, it's like All this was happening and he was like directing everything on stage. And then he would have to go to the monitors and go, okay, so next take, do this on this and this and set, make sure that's over here. And this person's doing this. And then he would do that for all the four units shooting at once. I can't imagine.
I would throw myself off a bridge. That was my job.
No, but it's, you know, those of us who really love it madly, you know, filmmaking and artist in our element when we're doing it, that kind of a challenge is just so exciting and fun. And you just feel like, I don't know, I guess you feel like a conductor of an orchestra. You're just like looking at everything. And like if it's in your head and if you have good people around you doing the stuff, then it's just so fun because you just get to kind of lead the orchestra and see it all unveil. So it's the ultimate high. I always say it's the, you know, I, you know, it's embarrassing to say, but I feel like I'm like a rock star when I'm on the set. It's just like it's like a performance in a way.
Sure, a conductor is probably the perfect analogy.
Yeah.
Rennie, I think that we're at the point of the show where we're going to need your Stephen King origin story, which is to say, when is the first time that Stephen King kind of showed up on your radar? You know, for us, it was the movies. For a lot of people, it was, you know, or seeing the book cover on the shelf. Yeah, it could be a million different things. And again, you do not need to be an expert here, but we are very curious what was the first time you kind of recognized the name of our, you know, our show's namesake.
Yes. I wonder if it's because I grew up in Finland and I, you know, I'd love to like track down now, like when did they start translating Stephen King's books into Finnish and publishing them in Finland and all that stuff. Because I was a big reader. I loved reading when I was young and I was just always reading, whether it was Edgar Allan Poe or the Sherlock Holmes novels or Jules Verne or you know, whatever, all these kind of dark and fantastical stories and so on. And I'm surprised when I think back that, you know, there has to be a reason why Stephen King didn't come into that mix on the book level. But to answer your question, it happened through movies. And my first memory is when I saw Carrie and I was probably, my guess would be, I was probably like 17 years old at that point when it came to Finland, and it was like it had to like the most serious rating you could have in Finland. You had to be like 112 to be let in the theater. But I snuck in and I was just blown away by that movie, and that's when I first kind of like studied like, okay, where did this come from, and realized that there was this writer Stephen King who had written the novel. That's how my love with him started, and then obviously, you know, seeing all the incredible movies that have been made from his novels and reading quite a few of them also, and just being, as I'm sure you say in every episode of your podcast, and everybody says the same thing, just the fact how prolific this guy has been in his career is a mind blower. I also used to write a lot when I was really, you know, just a kid growing up. I was always like writing my next novel, and they were always thrillers, and then it's kind of continued in script writing and stuff like that. And it's kind of always bugged me that I'm so busy professionally doing what I do that I don't have that time anymore to do what I used to do, which was just sit down and look at that, you know, in those days we still had typewriters, and you know, look at that clean page in your typewriter and start putting stuff on it, how inspiring it was. And I can only like imagine, like, because I remember as a kid when I got into the groove and I was writing really fast, and it's just like the story was just coming out so fast. And I imagine that there are few people on earth like that, and Stephen King is one of them. That it's obviously he's a genius, but it just must just come to him. Like, he just has to write it out because it's in his head, because right. You couldn't write that kind of books and that many of them if it was like a struggle and you have to really try to squeeze it out of yourself. Of course, right. It's, you know, it is hard work, but it's like he's just so unique.
It's unfathomable that anyone could produce that amount of writing. You know, some of those books
in so like many like different genres and everything. It's just like totally such different stories. It's astonishing.
Yeah, and for your title on the show today, you have picked basically the queen mother of Stephen King adaptations, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. This is a title when we started this show, we assumed that most of the people we reached out to guest on this show would go immediately to The Shining.
Yes.
And what we have found over time is that that's not necessarily true. I would say more people ask for Pet Sematary or, you know, Shawshank, or, you know, there's a number of titles that I think people are more interested in tackling. And I think that this title kind of intimidates people to talk about. But I am always happy to talk to any other filmmaker who wants to talk about The Shining, because it is always fascinating to hear what another filmmaker has to say about Stanley Kubrick. And so I'm curious, just as on a baseline level, like, you know, what are your thoughts on Kubrick? What are your favorites? Do you hold him in the same insanely high regard that everyone else does? Or, you know, like, where is your head at on Kubrick?
I think that obviously Kubrick was a total genius. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first movie of his that I saw was 2001, which just completely blew my mind.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, done that in just inserted his genius in so many different genres and types of movies, you know, like Paths of Glory and obviously The Shining. And I'll just be completely honest that I'm not such a huge fan of his kind of like later output of movies like something like Eyes Wide Shut.
Really?
I was not such a fan of that, but the earlier movies, I thought that he could just kind of take any genre and put his own stamp on it without it feeling like, oh, I'm just gonna do it my way, but like literally elevating it to something that no other filmmaker I think could do. His storytelling skills, his actor directing skills, and maybe more than anything, his visual skills that were so unique that you almost kind of could say like you could just tell, even if some people, if you didn't know and nobody told you, if you looked at a Stanley Kubrick film, you would know that it's a Stanley Kubrick film just because it's visually so so incredible. So
so when was the first time you saw The Shining? How old were you?
I think I was like 20, 21. I think it came out around like 1980.
Yes. So, correct.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And it just was. And also, you know, what's so special about him? You know, he was such an innovator. I have to also mention that I, you know, Space Odyssey was the first one that I saw, and I definitely the next one I saw in Finland was Clockwork Orange, and that was, you know, in like my totally formative years. I was like 12 or maximum 13 years old.
Yeah.
And it's just the images and the violence and all that stuff was, it was just
the soundtrack. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mind blowing stuff. And you know, there's so many, I mean, you know, I now I'm wondering, like, I probably even saw The Killing before that, you know, I was maybe like 10 years old when I saw The Killing. You know, Barry Lyndon and all this stuff. So he was such an innovator. Like, now I mentioned Barry Lyndon, you know, just to jump into that quickly, you know, like the whole movie was shot in candlelight, and this was, you know, while you know, cameras were these huge monsters and lenses were these, you know, 10-pound glass towers, and he just used completely unique technology to be able to shoot in candlelight. In those days, you know, movies were lit with heavy, huge lights. Today's world, of course, with all the digital equipment, you can shoot in available light. But in those days, just to innovate completely different kind of lens system that can produce those images, or what he did in 2001, or what he did with The Shining, where basically my feeling is that starting with the opening of the movie with those gliding helicopter shots following the VW bug through the mountainous roads, I had never seen images like that. Of course, there had been helicopter shots in the world before that, but all of a sudden we are really like gliding over and flying low over the lake and so on. So you immediately, he just wanted, you know, kind of like, there are very few filmmakers, like I can only like mention maybe like Hitchcock as somebody like where you know from the first image that you are in for something special. Like he is not going to waste any time. He's going to say, here's the first image and get ready. And so you just know that you are in for something special. And then what he did in all those sequences in the hotel with Steadicam, at least for me at that point, Steadicam was a completely new piece of equipment, and being able to follow the pedal car down the corridors and just the use of camera and all those labyrinth type of walking shots, running shots, following characters and leading characters and being the character's POV, all that, at least for me, was totally new technology and complete invention. So that just on that level, I think that he was totally genius. But I do know that The Shining is not Stephen King's favorite adaptation by any means. And
yeah.
And I'm not an expert on like why that is. And you probably know better, and you should tell me you should discuss it.
There's been a few different things, and by the way, he's evolved on this over the years, kind of at the beginning of everything, because The Shining wasn't very well received when it came out by critics, by fans, by readers of the book. It was nominated for the first Razzies, if you can imagine that, you know. Wow. Now it's this iconic, you know, thing in deemed like one of the best horror films of all time, but it really wasn't a giant, you know, it wasn't a blockbuster runaway crowd pleasing success, at least the history books say it wasn't.
Yeah.
But what King said, like back then he was like, oh, the quote is, I feel like I gave Kubrick a live grenade and he jumped on it for me. Like this was a big task for him to do, and that, like, oh, and boy, you know, he tried his hardest, you know, or whatever. And then it seems like over the years he got more and more mad at the movie. And I think a lot of it is because he put a lot of himself into Jack Torrance, and in the book Jack Torrance has a little bit of a redemption where it becomes more clear that the hotel is possessing him versus you know, Jack Nicholson being kind of crazy Jack from the get-go. And so that was like the main sticking point. And I just think he's put so much of his own struggles with alcoholism and all this stuff into the character. And my personal theory is that he just doesn't like seeing Jack as the bad guy, the irredeemable bad guy. He said, like, in terms of tone, that his novel is very warm and the Kubrick movie is very cold. The book ends with the hotel, the boiler blowing up and the hotel burns down. And so he's like, everything you need to know between like my version of the story and Kubrick's version of the story is his ends in ice and mine ends in fire. So, you know, I think he's, he went like from, oh, I feel bad for Stanley for having, you know, to go through this, to fuck that guy and fuck that movie, to now contractually I can't say bad things about it because he got the rights back to make the miniseries. So he's like, I'm not going to say talk about this anymore. And then when Mike Flanagan's Dr. Sleep came out, like he kind of came out and said, like, this has healed a lot of my thoughts on Kubrick's movie and merged, because merged King's writing with the Kubrick iconography. And I think that that you know, ultimately today he's probably still not gonna be a big fan of the movie, but I think he has softened now on it again. So
yeah,
that's kind of the long history of, King.
No, thank you for that. And I'm sure you've talked about this many times before, but maybe in this context,
in our talk,
it's a good thing for the audience also to hear that and get a little clarity on that. And it's obviously, it is when you write a book and you pour your soul into it, you have a very clear perspective, and it feels criminal when somebody kind of bends it into something else. And we've all had those experiences with books that we loved. Like it's so scary ever to you know, go to see a movie that is based on a novel, because it is super, super rare that the movie is on the same level or better. Because of course, you know, the novel can be 600 pages and you put all your imagination, all your life experience and the writer's life experience, and you combine all those into this incredible visual feast as you're reading it, and then you look at somebody's version, which is just a kind of a little slice of all that as a movie. And I've definitely had experiences did I say Love in the Time of Cholera? No, I didn't say that. there's been like books that I thought that were just life altering for me and just eye opening and like I was reading the Bible, and then somehow somebody ends up making a movie from that. And I'm like, did you even read the book? Did you understand any of the book?
Right.
And it just feels like my heart bleeds for the original novelist, you know, thinking how they must feel. So I totally understand that. Right. And I, you know, when I saw The Shining, it was really just, you know, I hadn't read the book, and it was just, you know, a movie for me. And I guess what I like in horror movies in general, like I think I personally prefer an atmosphere of dread and darkness and just fear and stressfulness. I think I prefer that to jump scares. Right. And so to me, the movie was just like, had such an incredible atmosphere, and it was sort of poetic in its, you know, the blood gushing from the elevators, the twin girls showing up, and that kind of stuff that just was so poetic and weird and nightmarish that it just really worked with me. And I'm actually must say that I haven't really gone back and you know, because when I saw the movie, I was still, you know, pretty young and didn't especially, you know, in Finland we didn't have access, you know, there was no internet and all this stuff,
so right.
I didn't have access to all these reviews. I might have seen one review in some Finnish newspaper, but like I never went back to really study like how it was received. And I'm pretty shocked to hear from you that it wasn't, the critics didn't really receive it well.
Welcome to the mid-roll ad read. We got one sponsor to tell you about before we jump back into this highly entertaining interview with Mr. Rennie Harlan, and that is to tell you a little bit about A24's I Saw the TV Glow. You can experience I Saw the TV Glow now playing in select cities from A24 and starring Justice Smith and Bridget Lundy Payne. Teenager Owen is just trying to make it through life in the suburbs when his classmate introduces him to a mysterious late-night TV show, a vision of a supernatural world beneath their own. In the pale glow of the television, Owen's view of reality begins to crack.
Critics are raving this, quote, coming-of-age masterpiece will follow you home. Don't miss I Saw the TV Glow, certified fresh, and now playing in select cities and nationwide May 17th. Get your tickets now.
And let's get back to the show. Yeah.
It's funny, and it's not just the critics, it's the fans, man. Like, if you go back and you read, like, the letter columns, you dig up some old back issues of Starlog or Fangoria or any of these genre mags that were out at the time, and they always have, like, those two or three pages where it's, like, the letters from the readers and whatnot. Yeah. And they're, like, calling for blood. They fucking thought he destroyed the book. And, like, listen, I've read that book three or four times now. I'm very much of the opinion, and I'm dyed in the wool on this. This is my hill. This is my soapbox to die on, that the two things work together very well. But also my barometer for a good adaptation is less about being extremely fidelious to the exact text. Everything has to be as it was, and more to the feeling that I get when I read The Shining. And that tone that you were talking about that Kubrick strikes in this movie is very much the slow dread tone of the book. Yeah. And so, like, I'll never be able to agree with the people that say, oh, it's a good movie, but it's a bad adaptation, because watching that movie gives me the exact same feeling I have reading that book, which is, it's an intangible. That is so much harder to pull off than just making sure that, you know, a character who survived in the book dies in the movie or vice versa. You know, it's like, like that is way more important to me. And maybe, you know, that's the reason why I can't ever fully see eye to eye on that argument.
Yeah. Interesting. By the way, you just taught me a new word, fidelius. I had never heard that before.
It might not be a real word.
I think that's a real word.
I know that there is a real word that means that, and it might I might have thrown in an extra syllable in there, but I'm not going to
let's use it
to admit that on air, because I'm, you know, of course, never wrong. So
Fidelius was the original password at the end of Eyes Wide Shut, and they changed it to Fidelius.
You know, next time I'm doing an interview for The Strangers, I'm going to start by saying, I want it to be fidelius to the original.
please do, especially if it turns out not to be a real word. This is the way that we Urban Dictionary this in the...
Yes.
We're going to bully Merriam-Webster's dictionary into making this real. So
Rennie, let's say that tomorrow you wake up and someone has a gun to your head and they're saying, you have to remake The Shining right now. It's a bad idea. Like, from the get-go, a bad idea. But you've got to do it. Who are you casting as Jack Torrance? Just to throw out an idea. Someone you've worked with before is Christian Slater, who strikes me as very Jack Nicholson-like.
Yes, but is that kind of exactly what you shouldn't do, because he definitely has that Jack Nicholson kind of a thing. But if you were forced to do this again, should you avoid that and try to come up with something?
Well, let's say you want somebody who can display the characteristics of an encroaching madness versus someone who can instantly leap to that, like Nicholson could, right? Or Christian Slater could. You know, is there an actor you can imagine that, or can name, who like could do that descent?
There's definitely an actor who could do it. I hate to say it, because everybody's going to say, like, well, that's so obvious because he's kind of done it. But James McAvoy, I think could play the
shit. Oh, that's interesting.
He would be super scary, and he could start as the sweetest, most normal family man, and take that journey. But he's kind of done that, you know, mad thing. But he does it so damn well. I can't think of anybody else who could do it so well.
I think that's the key. If anybody ever attempts to remake this, the key is to make the character of Jack Torrance more of a tragic figure than he is in the Kubrick movie. And in order to do that, you need somebody who you just love at the jump. But the, also the other side of this is the character as written, like he's actually way darker in the book than he is in the movie. You know, he not only does he have the backstory where he injured his kid in a drunken rage, you know, pulling him off of the his work papers and whatnot. But, you know, there's also the subplot about him being involved in a hit and run with a child. And it's like all this other stuff that, you know, a drunken DUI hit and run, you know, situation. So it's like, It's very funny to me because I do think the instinct is like, let's do show that arc, the happily go lucky family man. But then you also, if you kind of undercut the whole, struggling with his demons backstory, then it like guts the entire center out of the story for me. You know, there's gotta be something there for the hotel to prey on. So I just
want to say it's really interesting that you pick James McAvoy for this because he's starring in the American remake of Speak No Evil. Did you see the original Speak No Evil?
I'm not sure if I did.
Probably remember. It's very memorable. It's a super, super dark. God damn it. Is it Danish? I forget.
I think it's Danish, yeah.
Yeah, and it came out a few years ago, and it's one of those horror movies where all you heard about it beforehand was like, this movie will fuck you up. Like, it is dark as hell. And I saw it, and sure enough, it does fuck you up. Like, it is not an easy sit. But James McAvoy is playing the role in the Americanized remake of it, which it remains to be seen whether or not they're going to have the balls to see that remake through as they did with the original, you know, to its it's very
now I know exactly what movie you're talking about, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, if they go as far as the original.
But McAvoy is going to be playing he'll be playing along a similar arc, I think, and so
wonderful, you know, father and all those things. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, until he's not. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see if we'll get a taste of that performance, I think. So it's very interesting you say that.
By the way, just, you know, something to go on another track. What's interesting about novelizations is that because you mentioned that whole backstory in The Shining about the drunk driving accident and that kind of stuff, like, did you know, because I read The Jaws, Peter Benchley's The Jaws, a million years ago, and I don't remember much about it, but I remember vividly that very much in the center of a story was Brody's wife having an affair with somebody, having sex.
With Hooper, the Richard Dreyfuss character,
Okay, they're having sex in a motel. And it's like, okay, that's not very Spielbergian. so it's interesting.
That book is bonk. Jaws is my all-time favorite movie.
There's like mobsters and shit.
The whole reason why the mayor doesn't want to shut down the beaches is because the mob is leaning on him for some fucking reason. And you talked about books that it's rare for a book to be or a movie to be better than the book that it's adapting. And Jaws is like the gold standard example of the movie that is a million times better than the book. The Hooper dies in the book as well. Like, the shark eats him at the end and like jumps out of the water. And one of the things that I remember vividly from that book is Brody is shooting at the shark with his like little policeman, you know, pistol or whatever. Yeah. While dead Hooper is like hanging out of his mouth, and he hits Hooper in the neck, and then is then conflicted by the thoughts of like, oh, that's really gross because he's my friend, but also he's fucking my wife. Fuck that guy, you know, kind of thing. It is so bizarre. I'm delighted that you brought that up.
These are interesting parallels. Hopefully I'm not, you know, walking off the cliff here, but I gotta tell a parallel story that connects to this in a weird way.
Sure.
First phone call I literally got after the opening weekend of The Nightmare on Elm Street 4. Mm-hmm. And we're talking like, what is it, 87 or 88. And, you know, I'm 28 or 29 years old. I have no idea what my future is going to hold. And the movie has opened huge. And Monday morning, I get a call. I'm staying at this motel in Hollywood, $25 a night. That's the only thing I can afford because I don't have enough money to rent a place. And the manager says, hey, Harlan, you have a call. And long story short, on the phone is Steven Spielberg. And he's like, Rennie, this is Steve. I saw your movie over the week and I loved it. We got to meet. And I was just like, I thought somebody was pulling
a prank
on me. But it was Steven Spielberg. I have no idea how he got the phone number to the Magic Motel in Hollywood. But there he was. And so I drive in my $1,800 1971 mustard yellow convertible MGB wreck. I'm like Columbo, you know, it's like the fingers hanging off the thing and the exhaust pipe is smoking and the car is making weird sounds and the top doesn't even close. And I go to the gate and I'm like, Rennie Harlan, to see Mr. Spielberg. And they're like, look, here's your pass. You know where Amblin Entertainment is? I'm like, no. And they give me a map and I go to Amblin Entertainment. I meet with Spielberg and we had a fantastic meeting and he gives me a book. And he says, I want to have you read this and see if we can make a book out of this. I think you're the right guy to do this. And now, painfully, the name of the book escapes me, and maybe it's good. But I read the book, and I loved it. And the book was basically the genesis of the story in the book was the central character was like this 13-year-old boy who lives with his family, has an older sister who is maybe 16, 17. And also their grandfather is living with them. And there's, you know, all the normal things that go on in a family or typical things that are going on, basically. But what's special about the story is, and very Spielbergian, is that somehow our protagonist, the 13-year-old boy, acquires an ability to turn invisible for a certain amount of time at a time. So, you know, for like an hour, he can be invisible.
Right.
And the story is like his coming of age story of learning things about life. He sees his parents argue and be kind of on the verge of divorce. He sees his grandfather get deathly ill and kind of dying. And he sees his older sister have like a sexual relationship with this older boy and other stuff. And it's a great book. And it's just a great story of this, you know, boy, from his point of view, seeing all these things. And the only reason he sees these things because he can turn invisible, so he gets to be in those situations, observing them and having these pretty harsh lessons in life. And yeah. I loved it. And I went back. I read it in like a day. And I went back to Amblin, and I was like, I love this. And you know, you really want to make this into a movie. And then we started kind of developing it and having those development meetings and talking to writers. And to his geniusness, obviously, what Spielberg wanted to make was this kind of a, I would say maybe tonally, you know, something like Back to the Future or something like that. This kind of a, like a comedic coming of age story of a boy who can be invisible and then sees all these things and these madcap things happen to him and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that was genius Spielberg. Me as an idealistic young European director, I wanted to do this incredible, like, you know, the movie that I was seeing was kind of like a more edgy version of My Life as a Dog.
I was going to say like Lasse Hallström or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
And he's
a true coming of age story. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. You know, this is like, I want to make clear, this is no criticism towards Steven Spielberg whatsoever, but him being the biggest, most genius commercial director in the world, you know, he saw the potential to do something really, really commercial and so on. And then me being a passionate European crazy director, I was like, no, I don't want to make that version. I want to make this version. And then ultimately we parted ways, you know, in a very amicable and respectful and loving way, and talked about, you know, doing other things in the future, and, you know, always say hi to each other when we run into each other somewhere, but we never ended up making a movie together. But it was just one of those, I think, just because we're talking about this kind of the whole, right, the book adaptation thing, it's like a really, for me, a really personal example of like how you can take a premise of a novel and, you know, you can turn it into so many different things depending on who's producing and who's directing and what the studio is. And now, of course, later on, I understood that nobody would make the version that I wanted to make because, right, like, what's the audience? What are you going to do? Like an R-rated movie for 13-year-olds. So, right. So there's a problem there. But it just shows how, you know, the interpretation is all in the eye of the beholder.
You know, it's interesting we're talking about Spielberg because we talk a lot on this show about how Spielberg is sort of the flip side to Stephen King's coin. They are both very populist entertainers. They tend to write things that resonate with people on a universal level. And totally. And that's the key of their success. And they both have been criticized for their endings. The similarities are all over the place. But we tend to consider Stephen King the dark side of Steven Spielberg.
Totally.
It's a really great fucking story.
Though, yeah, great story and a great way to dovetail the two. I could talk to you for another few hours, man, but I know you're on a little bit of a time crunch and on the publicity circuit for Strangers. So I think we'll be murdered by the poor PR reps on this line if we keep you much longer. But I think now's a good time for you to kind of tell everybody, make the pitch for the Strangers Chapter One and tell them when they can see it, where they can see it, all that good stuff.
Well, the Strangers Chapter One. Like I said before, this really, you know, it is not a remake. It is not a sequel. We wanted to take this fantastic movie, honor it, honor the fans who love the original, like I'm total fanboy of the original film, but take it as a jumping off place and do this 4.5-hour exploration of these themes and these characters and explore a little bit, you know, what makes a serial killer tick and what happens to the victim of this kind of senseless violence. And the charm of the original film was, a big part of it was that it was senseless and it was unexplainable and it was just vicious and horrendous. And we are trying to definitely throughout these three movies to carry that torch proudly and have the same atmosphere of dread and fear and despair. And yes, we've made the three movies. The first one is completely finished. The second one is finished, but still needs to be printed. Third one, we are still working on post-production of the third one, but all of them have been shot. What we are probably doing a little differently than what's been done before in the cinematic universe is that we have three movies ready to go. And the first one is now coming out May 17th everywhere in America and pretty much in the rest of the world. And then the next one, without pissing off the studio, my guess would be maybe September, October. The second one will come out. And then the third one probably in the beginning of next year. And yes, one could say like, oh, is this kind of like taking the streaming model to the movie theater? It is an experiment. And in this case, they didn't just want to make one movie and wait a few years and do another one where everybody's changed and everything is different and you just have another Stranger story. We wanted to do one complete story that takes place basically in 5 days. It's kind of like taking the original movie and saying like, okay, if Liv Tyler did live, what happens the next day? And so the movie is coming out now everywhere and obviously, I'm super excited, and I my greatest wish is that the fans of the original will embrace this and will understand that we are doing this out of love and respect and not copying the movie, but hopefully replicating the experience so that the audience will enjoy the same kind of feelings and emotions that they originally had, and then expanding on it. And yeah, it's you know, before you like turn the sound off or something, I just, you know, want to say, you know, Eric and Scott, it's been such a pleasure talking with you, and just to talk to people who know about all this stuff, like where you can like throw out any reference, whether it's literal, you know about the literary world or movies or whatever, and you just get it. Like you said, like we could talk for many more hours. Let's do it. Let's get together, you know, whatever. And if not sooner, then at the latest, when the next chapter comes out, I would love to talk more with you guys.
And so fucking lovely. You know,
it's been awesome. I'm totally jazzed. I'm totally inspired.
Oh. Well, thank you so much for being here. We wish you the best of luck with this trilogy. And I'm, you know, like you, I'm very curious to see what happens with this experiment that you're doing, rolling out these movies like this. And I will talk to you again at the drop of a goddamn hat. You have been an incredibly entertaining guest, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you. My pleasure. You guys have a great day. Where are you guys based at?
Austin.
What city?
Yeah, we're in Austin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Austin. Okay. I love Austin. I've spent some amazing nights in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, same.
And we'll get to that next time.
Next time. More on that.
Yes.
Many thanks to my new best friend, Rennie Harlan.
Yes.
That was a hell of a fucking episode.
What a whirlwind.
Man. Yeah. We've been talking it up on social medias. I hope it lives up to the hype, but I can't express to you just how over the moon that Scott and I were with that one. We were like floating on air after he signed off going, how good was that? How awesome was that, dude?
Yeah, this was one where like the offer came in and Vespi was like, hey, I'm going to try to get Rennie Harlan on the show. And I was like, Rennie Harlan? All right. Well, you know, like, I mean, of all people, right. The last person I would ever expect to be showing up on the KingCast, but
yeah.
And then I had no sense of him as a person before we recorded this. Like I only knew the movies, that was it. And I knew like he had been married to Gina Davis. That was really the extent of my Rennie Harlan knowledge. And he just like from before we were even recording, he was charming our pants off. Just what a riot to talk to that dude.
I love that we never really had to pull an answer out of him if we wanted. Just the mere mention of Freddy Krueger, and he tells the like the most awesome story about working on Nightmare on Elm Street. It's like, I don't know. I was very happy with that dude. Like, if he wants to come on and be our third co-host, the offer's extended. He's welcome back anytime he wants.
Well, we did talk to him after the show. I do not believe you've heard the last of us talking to Rennie Harlan. I will put it that way. But the show goes on. What's coming up next week? I had no transition there.
Yes, it works. It works. I buy it. Just to show just how bonkers our booking is and how we go from one fairly random sounding like, again, who would have thought Rennie Harlan would have come on our Stephen King podcast. Mm-hmm. Now we're gonna next week we're talking to one of the most celebrated comic book authors of all time, Mr. Scott Snyder.
Yes.
Now this one makes a little bit more sense because even though he's like famous for writing the Court of Owls saga for Batman and he's done all these giant IP stuff, he's also worked on a comic book with Stephen King that he co-wrote with Stephen King. So this one, there's a little bit more King connective tissues, but Scott Snyder, he's a giant fan of King and he chose to do one of the short stories, which is interesting. It's a short story called One for the Road, which if you diehard Stephen King fans will remember, that's the short story sequel to Salem's Lot. You know, it's one of the better vampire stories that I think King has told. It's one where the vampires are actually really scary. And we kind of dive into that. So we talk a lot about that. We talk about its relationship to Salem's Lot. Mm-hmm. His comic book that he wrote with Stephen King was a vampire comic book. It's called American Vampire, wasn't it, Scott?
Yes. Which I accidentally refer to as American Nightmare somewhere in that episode. Like,
I'm going to actually pump up the volume on that part just to really underline.
Which was the name to like an Alan Wake DLC or something at some point. Right. But I just conflated them in my mind. And then like, I don't know, 20 minutes later in the conversation, I realized, wait, did I say American Nightmare? Yeah, I did. Sorry. Sorry, Scott Snyder, you were a great guest.
Yep. Yeah, it's a great episode. It's a little bit more of a deep dive into King's writing. And, you know, from a writer, you kind of get that. Sometimes if they're really into King, that they'll, you know, talk about the influences and all that stuff. So this one will be a little bit more analytical, where the Rennie Harlan one was just kind of a great pub conversation, I feel like, where we lightly talk about some Stephen King shit from time to time. If you're missing the hardcore Stephen King, let's look at his writing stuff, that'll be next week's episode with Scott Snyder.
Absolutely. And I realize we did not, I have no idea. What are we doing on the Patreon this week?
Our Patreon episode this week is Shelbyville episode 11.
Ooh, real close to the end.
Yeah, there's 13 episodes in the second season. And the last few ones, I feel like we've talked up how like the noose is tightening and our characters are really like kind of under the gun. The shit's getting real now. Like there's the threats to our RPG characters are pretty dire. The situation's dire, and you know, who knows what's going to happen. So I mean, we know because we've recorded it all. But if you're not familiar, Shelbyville's our Stephen King themed RPG that is me and Scott playing characters named Bug and Bruce, and our good friends Mallory O'Mara and Jacob Hall are along for the ride. Mallory plays Crystal and Jacob is our GM, and we get up to some nonsense in a fictionalized sister city to Castle Rock, the rival city, Shelbyville. It's a wild show. It's got a dedicated following. We're very proud of it, and we're very excited for everybody to see how things are coming to a head in the season, and we're getting into the thick of it now. If you haven't signed up already, head on over to our Patreon. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. And throw us a few bucks and you can get access to all of the Shelbyville episodes last season and this season. You can get access to all of our bonus episodes, interviews, commentaries, whatnot. We have some really great stuff that we've done over the last few years. And throw us a few bucks. We make it worth your while.
We absolutely do.
Yeah. So we'll see y'all next week for our chat with Scott Snyder in the main feed, and then for episode 11 of Shelbyville on our Patreon.
Adios, folks.
Bye. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abby Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.